I'm told I have considerable value as a scapegoat, should the Americans decide to hang me. Where was that bloody note from Hal? Who had it now? Watson Smith? General Wayne? Well, that won't do at all, will it? Percy appeared undisturbed at thought of Gray's imminent demise. Don't worry, I'll have a word. With whom? He asked, curious. General Lafayette, Percy said, adding with a slight bow, to whom I have the honour of being an adviser. Thank you, Gray said dryly. I'm not concerned with the possibility of being hanged, at least not right this minute. But I want to know what the devil you mean about my son, William. This would be much easier over a bottle of port, Percy said with a sigh. But time doesn't permit, alas. Sit down, at least. You look as though you're going to fall on your face. Gray sat with as much dignity as he could muster, and glared up at Percy. To put it as simply as possible, and it's not simple, I assure you. There is a British officer named Richardson. I know him, Gray interrupted. I know you do. Be quiet. Percy flapped a hand at him. He's an American spy. He... what? For an instant, he thought he might really fall on his face, despite the fact of sitting down, and grasped the cot's frame with both hands to prevent this. He told me that he proposed to arrest Mrs. Fraser for distributing seditious materials. That was what caused me to marry her. You? Percy goggled at him. You? Married? Certainly, Gray said crossly. So did you, or so you told me. Go on about bloody Richardson. How long has he been spying for the Americans? Percy snorted, but obliged. I don't know. I became aware of him in the spring of last year, but he may well have been at it before that. Active fellow, I'll give him that. And not content with merely gathering information and passing it on, either. He's what one might call a provocateur. He's not the only one who's provoking, Gray muttered, resisting the urge to rub his bad eye. What's he got to do with William? He was beginning to have an unpleasant feeling in his abdomen. He had given William permission to undertake small intelligence-gathering missions for Captain Richardson, who, put as bluntly as possible, he's tried more than once to lure your son into a position where he might appear to have sympathies with the rebels. I gather that last year he sent him into the Great Dismal in Virginia with the intention that he should be captured by a nest of rebels who have a bastion there. Presumably, they would let it be known that he had deserted and joined their forces while actually holding him prisoner. What for? Gray demanded. Will you bloody sit down? Looking up at you is giving me a headache. Percy snorted again and sat, not on the conveniently placed stool, but beside Gray on the camp bed, hands on his knees. Presumably to discredit your family. Pardlow was making rather inflammatory speeches in the House of Lords at the time, about the conduct of the war. He made a small, impatient gesture that John recognized, a quick flutter of the fingers. I don't know everything yet, but what I do know is that he's arranged to have your son taken during the journey to New York. He's not bothering with indirection or politics. Things have changed now that France has come into the war. This is simple abduction, with the intent of demanding your and Pardlow's cooperation in the matter of the Northwest Territory, and possibly something else, as the price of the boy's life. Gray closed his good eye in an effort to stop his head spinning. 2 years before, Percy had abruptly re-ended his life, bearing a proposal from certain French interests, to wit, that these interests wanted the return of the valuable Northwest Territory, presently held by England, and, in return for assistance in achieving that goal, would offer their influence to keep France from entering the war on the side of the Americans. Things have changed, he repeated with an edge. Percy inhaled strongly through his nose. Admiral D'Estaing sailed from Toulon with a fleet in April. If he's not already off New York, he will be shortly. General Clinton may or may not know that.
Jesus.
He clenched his fists on the bed frame, hard enough to leave marks from the nail heads. So the bloody French had now officially entered the war. They'd signed a treaty of alliance with America in February and declared war on England in March. But talk was cheap. Ships and cannon and men cost money. Suddenly, he grasped Percy's arm, squeezing hard.
"And where do you come into this?" he said, his voice level and cold. "Why are you telling me all this?"
Percy drew breath, but didn't jerk away. He returned Gray's stare, brown eyes clear and direct.
"Where I come into it doesn't matter," he said, "and there isn't time. You need to find your son quickly. As to why, I tell you."
John saw it coming and didn't pull away. Percy smelled of bergamot and pettigrain and the red wine on his breath. John's grip on Percy's arm loosened.
"Bravo, Bouzieu,"
Percy had whispered against his lips.
And laughed. Damn him.
Chapter 74. The sort of thing that will make a man sweat and tremble. We followed in the wake of the army. Because of the speed of march, the soldiers had been instructed to jettison their non-essential equipment, and I had had to abandon many of my supplies as well. Still, I was mounted, and thus would be able to keep up, even loaded with what I managed to keep. After all, I reasoned, it would do me no good to catch up with the army if I had nothing with which to treat wounds when I did. I had Clarence packed with as much as he could reasonably be expected to carry. As he was a large mule, this was a substantial amount, including my small tent, a folding camp bed for surgery, and all I could cram in terms of bandages, lint, and disinfectant. I had both a small cask of purified saline solution and a couple of bottles of straight ethyl alcohol, these disguised as poison, with large skull and crossbones labels painted on. Also a jug of sweet oil for burns, my medicine chest, and bundles of raw herbs, large jars of prepared ointment, and dozens of small bottles and vials of tinctures and infusions. My surgical instruments, stitching needles and sutures, were in their own small box, this in a haversack with extra bandage rolls to be carried on my person. I left Clarence tied and went to find out where the hospital tents were to be set up. The camp was milling with non-combatants and support personnel, but I was finally able to locate Denny Hunter, who told me that on the basis of General Green's reports, the surgeons were to be dispatched to the village of Freehold, where there was a large church that could be used as a hospital.
"The last thing I've heard is that Lee has taken command of the force attacking the British rear, and means to encircle the British," he said, polishing his spectacles on the tail of his shirt.
"Lee? But I thought he didn't think it an important command and wouldn't take it."
"I wouldn't care one way or the other, save that Jamie and his companies would be engaged in that mission, and I had my own doubts about General Lee."
Denzel shrugged, putting his spectacles back on and tucking in his shirt tail.
"Apparently Washington decided that 1,000 men were insufficient to his purpose, and raised the number to 5,000, which Lee considered more appropriate to his sense of his own importance."
Denny's mouth twisted a little at this. He looked at my face, though, and touched my arm gently.
"We can but put our trust in God, and hope that the Lord has his eye upon Charles Lee. Will thee come with the girls and me, Claire? Thy mule will bide with us willingly."
I hesitated for no more than a moment. If I rode Clarence, I could take only a fraction of the equipment and supplies he could otherwise carry. And while Jamie had said he wanted me with him, I knew quite well that what he really meant was that he wanted to be assured of where I was, and that I was near at hand if he needed me.
"Thy husband does trust me with thy welfare," Denny said, smiling, having plainly divined what I was thinking.
"Et tu, Brute?" I said rather curtly. And when he blinked, added more civilly, "I mean,
Does everyone know what I'm thinking, all of the time?
Oh, I doubt it, he said, and grinned at me. If they did, I expect a number of them would take a deal more care in what they said to thee.
I rode in Denny's wagon with Dotty and Rachel, Clarence pacing stolidly along behind, tied to the tailboard. Dotty was flushed with heat and excitement. She had never been near a battle before. Neither had Rachel, but she had helped her brother during a very bad winter at Valley Forge, and had much more idea of what the day might hold.
"Does thee think perhaps thee should write to thy mother?"
I heard Rachel ask seriously. The girls were behind Denny and me, sitting in the bed of the wagon, and keeping things from bouncing out when we hit ruts and mud bogs.
"No? Why?"
Dotty's tone was wary, not quite hostile, but very reserved. I knew she'd written to tell her mother that she intended to wed Denzel Hunter, but she hadn't received a reply. Given the difficulties of correspondence with England, though, there was no assurance that Minerva Gray had ever read the letter. It occurred to me, with a sudden qualm, that I hadn't written a letter to Brianna in several months. I hadn't been able to bear to write about Jamie's death, and there hadn't been time since his return even to think about it.
"It is a war, Dotty," Rachel said. "Unexpected things may happen. And thee would not wish thy mother to, well, to discover that thee had perished without some assurance that she was in thy heart?"
"Hmm," said Dotty, clearly taken aback.
Beside me, I felt Denzel shift his weight, bending a little forward as he took a fresh grip on the reins. He glanced aside at me, and his mouth turned up in an expression that was as much grimace as smile, acknowledging that he'd been listening to the girls talk too. "She worries for me," he said very quietly, "never for herself." He let go the reins with one hand to rub a knuckle under his nose. "She has as much courage as her father and brothers."
"As much pig-headedness, you mean," I said under my breath,
and he grinned despite himself.
"Yes," he said.
He glanced over his shoulder, and so did I, but the girls had moved to the tailboard and were talking over it to Clarence, brushing flies off his face with the needles of a long pine twig.
"Does thee think it a familial lack of imagination? For in the case of the men of her family, it cannot be ignorance of the possibilities."
"No, it certainly can't," I agreed, with a note of ruefulness. I sighed and stretched my legs a little.
"Jamie is the same way, and he certainly doesn't lack for imagination. I think it's..."
I made a small, helpless gesture.
"Perhaps acceptance is the word."
"Acceptance of the fact of mortality."
He was interested and pushed his spectacles back into place.
"We have discussed that, Dorothea and I."
He nodded back toward the girls.
"Friends live in the certain knowledge that this world is temporary, and there is nothing to fear in death."
"Some of that, perhaps." In fact, almost everyone in this time had a very matter-of-fact acceptance of mortality. Death was a constant presence at everyone's elbow, though they regarded that presence in a variety of ways. But they, those men, what they do is something different, I think. It's more an acceptance of what they think God made them.
"Really?"
He seemed slightly startled by that, and his brows drew together in consideration.
"What does he mean by that? That they believe God has created them deliberately to..."
"To be responsible for other people, I think," I said. I couldn't say whether it's the notion of noblesse oblige. Jamie was a laird, you know, in Scotland. Or just the idea that... "That's what a man does," I ended rather lamely.
Because that was plainly not what Denzel Hunter thought a man should do. Though I did wonder a bit. Plainly the question troubled him a little.
As well it might, given his position.
I could see that the prospect of battle excited him, and the fact that it did troubled him a great deal.
"You're a very brave man," I said quietly, and touched his sleeve. "I saw that. when you played Jamie's deserter game after Ticonderoga.
It wasn't courage, I assure thee, he said, with a short, humourless laugh. I didn't seek to be brave. I only wanted to prove that I was.
I made a rather disrespectful noise. I wasn't in either Jamie's or Ian's class, but I had picked up a few pointers. And he glanced at me in surprise. I do appreciate the distinction, I told him, but I've known a lot of brave men in my time. But how can thee know what lies? Be quiet.
I waved my fingers at him. Brave covers everything from complete insanity and bloody disregard of other people's lives. Generals tend to go in for that sort. To drunkenness, foolhardiness, and outright idiocy. To the sort of thing that will make a man sweat and tremble and throw up. And go and do what he thinks he has to do anyway.
Which, I said, pausing for breath and folding my hands neatly in my lap, is exactly the sort of bravery you share with Jamie.
Thy husband does not sweat and tremble, he said dryly. I've seen him. Or rather, I have not seen him do such things.
He does the sweating and trembling on the inside, mostly, I replied. Though he really does often vomit before, or during a battle. Denzel blinked once, and didn't speak for a bit, absorbed, apparently, in steering his way past a large hay wagon, whose oxen had suddenly decided they didn't want to go any farther, and stopped dead in the middle of the road. At last he took a breath and let it out explosively.
I am not afraid to die, he said. That isn't my difficulty.
What is? I asked, curious. Are you afraid of being maimed and left helpless? I certainly would be.
No.
His throat moved as he swallowed.
It's Dorothea and Rachel. I'm afraid I would lack the courage to see them die without trying to save them, even if that meant killing someone.
I couldn't think of anything to say to this, and we jolted on in silence.
Lee's troops left Englishtown about 6 a.m., heading east toward Monmouth Courthouse. Lee arrived at the courthouse at about 9:30 to find that the bulk of the British army had left, presumably moving toward Middletown, as that was where the road went. Lee was prevented from following, though, by the presence of a small but very belligerent rear guard under the command of General Clinton himself. Or so Ian told Jamie, having got close enough to see Clinton's regimental banners. Jamie had communicated this information to Lee, but saw no evidence that it affected either that gentleman's plan of action, always assuming that he had one, or his disinclination to send out more scouts to reconnoitre.
"Go round this lot and see if you can find out where Cornwallis is," Jamie told Ian. "The grenadiers you saw are likely Hessians, so they'll be close to von Knyphausen."
Ian nodded and took the full canteen Jamie offered him.
"Shall I tell General Lee if I do? He didn't seem much interested in what I had to say. Aye, tell him if you see him before you see me. Tell the Marquis, too, should you come within reach of him. But find me regardless, aye?"
Ian grinned at him and slung the canteen over his pommel.
Good hunting, Avraham Ahir.
Jamie had had two companies blooded by mid-morning, skirmishing near Monmouth Courthouse, but no one killed yet, and only three wounded badly enough to retire. Colonel Owen had requested cover for his artillery. Only two cannon, but any artillery was welcome. And Jamie had sent Thomas Meleager's Pennsylvanians to deal with that. He'd sent one of Captain Kirby's companies to reconnoitre toward what he thought was the creek, and kept back the rest, waiting for orders from Lafayette or Lee. Lafayette was somewhere ahead of him, Lee well behind and to the east with the main body of his troops. The sun stood just short of 10 o'clock when a messenger appeared, crouched dramatically in his saddle as though dashing through a hail of bullets, though in fact there was not a British soldier in sight. He pulled his lathered horse to a stop and gasped out his message.
"There's dust clouds in the east. Might be more redcoats coming. And the Marquis says there's redcoat cannon in the cider orchard, sir,
and will you do something about it, please?
The sweating messenger gulped air, loosening his rein in obvious preparation for dashing off again. Jamie leaned over and seized the horse's bridle to prevent it.
Where is the cider orchard? He asked calmly.
The messenger was young, maybe 16, and wild-eyed as his raw-boned horse.
Dunno, sir, he said,
and began glancing to and fro as though expecting the orchard to materialize suddenly out of the meadow they were standing in. A sudden distant boom reverberated in Jamie's bones, and his horse's ears pricked up.
Never mind, lad, he said. I hear them. Breathe your horse, or he's like to die under you before the sun's high.
Letting go the bridle, he waved to Captain Craddock and turned his own horse's head toward the sound of cannon. The American army had several hours lead on him, and the British army very much more. But a man alone could move a great deal faster than even a company of light infantry. Neither was John burdened with weapons, or food, or water.
You know perfectly well that he's lying to you.
Oh, be quiet, Hal, Gray muttered to his brother's shade. I know Percy a great deal better than you do.
I said, you know perfectly well I do.
What am I risking if he's lying?
And what am I risking if he's not?
Hal was high-handed but logical. He was also a father. That shut him up. What he was risking if Percy was lying was being shot or hanged out of hand if anyone recognized him. Anyone. If the Americans found him out before he reached the British lines, they'd arrest him for breaking his parole and promptly execute him as a spy. If the British didn't recognize him in time, they'd shoot him on sight as rebel militia. He put a hand in the pocket where he'd wadded the liberty or death cap and debated the wisdom of throwing it away, but in the event, kept it. What he was risking if Percy wasn't lying was Willie's life. No great effort required to call the odds. It was mid-morning, and the air was like treacle, thick and sweet with flowers, sticky with tree sap, and completely unbreathable. His good eye was beginning to itch from the floating pollen grains, and flies were buzzing interestedly around his head, drawn by the scent of honey. At least the headache had gone away, dispelled by the burst of alarm, and a brief flare of lust, might as well admit it, occasioned by Percy's revelation. He wouldn't begin to speculate as to Percy's motives, but... "For your beautiful eyes, indeed," he muttered, but couldn't help smiling at the impudence. A wise man wouldn't touch Percy Wainwright with a 10-foot pole. Something shorter, though. Oh, do be quiet, will you? He murmured to himself, and made his way down a clay bank to the edge of a tiny creek, where he could throw cold water on his heated face. It was perhaps 8 o'clock in the morning when we reached Freehold, where Tennant Church was to be established as the main hospital. It was a large building, set in the midst of a huge, sprawling churchyard, an acre or more of ground, whose headstones were as individual as doubtless their owners had been in life. No neat aisles of uniform white crosses here. I spared a thought for the graves of Normandy, and wondered whether those rows upon rows of faceless dead were meant to impose a sort of post-mortem tidiness on the costs of war, or whether it was meant rather to underline them, a solemn accounting, carried out in endless rows of noughts and crosses. But I didn't think long. Battle had been joined already, somewhere, and there were already wounded coming in, a number of men sitting in the shade of a large tree next to the church, more coming down the road, some staggering with the help of friends, some being carried on litters, or in someone's arms. My heart lurched at the sight, but I tried not to look for Jamie or Ian. Should they be among the early wounded, I'd know it soon enough. There was a bustle near the church's porch, where the double doors had been flung wide to accommodate passage, and orderlies and surgeons were coming and going in haste, but organized haste, so far. "Go and see what's happening, why don't you?" I suggested to Denzel. "The girls and I will unload things." He paused long enough to unhitch his own two mules and hobble them, then hastened into the church. I found the buckets and dispatched Rachel and Dotty to find a well. The day was already uncomfortably hot. We were going to need a good deal of water one way or another. Clarence was showing a strong urge to go join Denny's mules in cropping grass among the headstones, jerking his head against the pull of his tether and uttering loud cries of annoyance. "All right, all right, all right," I said, hurrying to undo the packing straps and lift his burdens off. "Hold your..." Oh, dear. A man was staggering toward me, giving at the knees with every step and lurching dizzily. The side of his face was black, and there was blood down the facing of his uniform. I dropped the bundle of tenting and poles and rushed to catch him by the arm before he should trip over a headstone and fall face first into the dirt. "Sit down," I said. He looked dazed and appeared not to hear me, but as I was pulling on his arm, he did go down, letting his knees relax abruptly and nearly taking me with him as he landed on a substantial stone commemorating one Gilbert Tennant. My patient was swaying as though about to fall over, and yet a hasty check showed me no significant wounds. The blood on his coat was from his face, where the blackened skin had blistered and split. It wasn't just the soot of black powder. The skin had actually been burned to a crisp, the underlying flesh seared, and my patient smelled appallingly like a pork roast. I took a firm grip on my lurching stomach and stopped breathing through my nose. He didn't respond to my questions, but stared hard at my mouth, and he seemed lucid despite his continued swaying. The penny finally dropped. "Explosion," I mouthed with exaggerated care, and he nodded vigorously, then stopped abruptly, swaying so far that I had to grasp him by the sleeve and pull him upright. Artilleryman, from his uniform. So something big had exploded near him. A mortar, a cannon, and not only burned his face nearly to the bone, but also likely burst both his eardrums and disturbed the balance of his inner ear. I nodded and set his hands to grip the stone he sat on to keep him in place while I hastily finished unloading Clarence, who was making the welkin ring with frustration. I should have realized at once that the artilleryman was deaf, as he was taking no notice of the racket, hobbled him, and set him loose to join Denny's mules in the shade. I dug what I needed out of the packs, and set about to do what little I could for the injured man, this consisting mostly of soaking a towel in saline and applying it to his face like a poultice, to remove as much soot as I could without scrubbing. I thank God that I'd had the forethought to bring a jug of sweet oil for burns, and cursed my lack of it for not having asked for aloe at Bartram's garden. The girls hadn't yet returned with water. I hoped there was a well somewhere close at hand. Creek water so close to an army couldn't be used without boiling it. That thought led me to look round for a spot where a fire could be lighted, and to make a mental note to send the girls to look for wood next. My mind was jerked from my rapidly expanding mental checklist, though, by Denny's sudden emergence from the church. He wasn't alone. He appeared to be having a passionate argument with another Continental officer. With a brief exclamation of exasperation, I dug in my pocket and found my silk-wrapped spectacles. With these on my nose, the face of Denny's interlocutor sprang into clear focus. "Captain Leckie, diplomate of the Medical College of Philadelphia." My patient tugged at my skirt, and when I turned to him, apologetically opened his mouth and mimed drinking. I held up a finger, adjuring him to wait one moment, and went to see whether Denzel required reinforcement. My appearance was greeted by an austere look from Captain Leckie, who viewed me rather as he might have looked at something questionable on the bottom of his shoe. "Mrs. Fraser," he said coldly, "I've just been telling your Quaker friend that there is no room inside the church for cunning women, or—"
"Claire Fraser is the most skillful surgeon I have seen operate," Denzel said.
He was flushed and fairly bristling with anger.
You will do your patients great harm, sir, by not allowing her to. And where did you obtain your training, Dr. Hunter, that you are so confident of your own opinion?
In Edinburgh, Denny said through his teeth, where I was trained by my cousin, John Hunter. Seeing that this made no impact on Leckie, he added, and his brother, William Hunter, accoucheur to the Queen.
That took Leckie aback, but unfortunately also got up his nose.
I see, he said, dividing a faint sneer evenly between us. I congratulate you, sir, but as I doubt the army requires a man midwife, perhaps you should assist your colleague.
And here he actually flared his nostrils at me, the pompous little swine, with her seeds and potions rather than...
We haven't time for this, I interrupted firmly. Dr. Hunter is both a trained physician and a duly appointed surgeon in the Continental Army. You can't bloody keep him out. And if my experience of battle, which I venture to suggest may be somewhat more extensive than your own, sir, is anything to go on, you'll need every hand you can get.
I turned to Denzel and gave him a long, level look. Your duty is with those who need you. So is mine. I told you about triage, did I not? I have a tent and my own surgical instruments and supplies. I'll do triage out here, deal with the minor cases, and send in anyone requiring major surgery.
I had a quick look over my shoulder, then turned back to the two fuming men. You'd best go inside and be quick about it. They're starting to pile up.
This was not a metaphorical expression. There was a crowd of walking wounded under the trees, a few men lying on makeshift stretchers and sheets of canvas, and a small, sinister heap of bodies. These, presumably men who had died of their wounds en route to the hospital. Fortunately, Rachel and Dottie appeared at this moment, each lugging a heavy bucket of water in each hand. I turned my back on the men and went to meet them. "Dottie, come and put up the tent poles, will you?" I said, taking her buckets. "And Rachel, you know what arterial bleeding looks like, I imagine. Go and look through those men and bring me anyone who's doing it."
I gave my burnt artilleryman water, then helped him to his feet. As he stood up, I saw behind his legs the epitaph carved into Gilbert Tennant's headstone.
O reader, had you heard his last testimony, you would have been convinced of the extreme madness of delaying repentance.
I suppose there are worse places to be doing this, I remarked to the artilleryman,
but unable to hear me, he simply raised my hand and kissed it, before swaying off to sit down on the grass, the wet towel pressed to his face.
Chapter 75 The Cider Orchard. The first shot took them by surprise, a muffled boom from the cider orchard, and a slow roll of white smoke. They didn't run, but they stiffened, looking to him for direction. Jamie said to those near him, "Good lads," then raised his voice. "To my left now, Mr. Craddock, Reverend Woodsworth, circle them. Come into the orchard from behind. The rest, scatter to the right and fire as you can." The second crash drowned his words, and Craddock jerked like a puppet with his strings cut and dropped to the ground, blood spraying from the blackened hole in his chest. Jamie's horse shied violently, nearly unseating him. "Go with the Reverend," he shouted at Craddock's men, who stood there drop-jawed, staring at their captain's body. "Go, now!" One of the men shook himself, grabbed the sleeve of another, pulled him away, and then they all began to move as a body. Woodsworth, bless him, raised his musket overhead and roared, "To me! Follow me!" and broke into the stalk-legged shamble that passed with him for running. But they followed him. The gelding had settled, but was moving uneasily. He was, supposedly, used to the sound of guns, but he didn't like the strong smell of blood. Jamie didn't like it either.
"Shouldn't we bury Mr. Craddock?" a timid voice suggested behind him. "He's not dead like Brain."
Jamie glanced down. He wasn't, but it wouldn't be more than a few seconds longer.
"Go with God, man," he said quietly.
Craddock didn't blink. His eyes were fixed on the sky, not yet dull, but sightless.
"Go with your fellows," he said to the two lingerers,
then saw that they were Craddock's two sons, maybe 13 or 14, white-faced and staring as sheep.
"Say farewell to him," he said abruptly. "He'll still hear you." "Then go."
He thought for a moment to send them to Lafayette, but they'd be no safer there.
"Run!"
They ran. They were a deal safer running, and with a gesture to Lieutenants Auden and Bixby, he wheeled his horse to the right, following Guthrie's company. The cannon were firing more regularly from the orchard. He saw a ball bounce past 10 feet away, and the air was thickening with smoke. He could still smell Craddock's blood. He found Captain Moxley and sent him with a full company to look at the farmhouse on the far side of the orchard.
"At a distance, mind. I want to know if the redcoats are in it or if the family's still there. If the family's there, surround the house. Go inside if they'll let you, but don't force your way. If there are soldiers inside and they come out after you, engage them and take the house if you think you can. If they stay inside, don't stir them up. Send someone back to tell me. I'll be at the back of the orchard, the north side."
Guthrie was waiting for him, the men lying flat in the long grass behind the orchard. He left the two lieutenants with his horse, which he tied to a fence rail, well out of range of the orchard, and scrambled along to the company, keeping low. He dropped to his belly by Bob Guthrie.
"I need to know where the cannon are, exactly where they are, and how many. Send 3 or 4 men in from different directions, going canny. You know what I mean?" "Aye. They're not to do anything. See what they can, and come out again, fast."
Guthrie was panting like a dog, stubbled face awash with sweat, but he grinned and nodded and wormed his way off through the grass. The meadow was dry, brown and brittle in the summer heat, Jamie's stockings prickled with foxtails, and the warm, sharp scent of ripe hay was stronger than that of black powder. He gulped water from his canteen. It was nearly empty. It wasn't yet noon, but the sun was coming down on them like a flat iron. He turned to tell one of the lieutenants who'd been following him to go and find the nearest water, but nothing moved in the grass behind him save hundreds of grasshoppers whirring up like sparks. Gritting his teeth against the stiffness in his knees, he scrambled up onto hands and feet and scuttled back toward his horse. Auden was lying 10 feet away, shot through one eye. Jamie froze for an instant, and something whirred close past his cheek.
It might be a grasshopper, and it might not.
He was flat to the earth beside the dead lieutenant, heart pounding in his ears before the thought had fully formed.
"Guthrie!"
He daren't raise his head to call out, but had to. He got his feet under him as best he could, shot out of the grass, and ran like a rabbit, to and fro, zigzagging away from the orchard as best as he could, while still going in the direction he'd sent Guthrie. He could hear the shots now, more than one sniper in the orchard, protecting the cannon, and the sound was the flat crack of a rifle.
"Jaegers!"
He flung himself down and crawled madly, now shouting for Guthrie.
"Here, sir!"
The man popped up suddenly beside him like a groundhog, and Jamie seized Guthrie's sleeve, pulling him back down.
"Get your men back!"
He gulped air, chest heaving.
"Shooting from the orchard. This side. I'll be picked off."
Guthrie was staring at him, mouth half open.
"Get them!"
Shaken out of his shock, Guthrie nodded like a puppet and started to rise. Jamie grabbed him by the ankle and jerked him flat, pressed him down with a hand on his back.
"Don't stand up."
His breathing was slowing, and he managed to speak calmly.
"We're still in range here. Get your men and retire with your company back to the ridgeline. Join Captain Moxley. Tell him to come round and join me."
His mind went blank for a moment, trying to think of some reasonable place for a rendezvous.
South of the farmhouse, with Woodbine's company,
He took his hand off Guthrie.
"Aye, sir."
The man scuffed up onto hands and knees, reaching for the hat that had fallen off. He glanced back at Jamie, eyes full of earnest concern.
"Are you hit bad, sir? Hurt? There's blood all down your face, sir."
"That's nothing. Go."
Guthrie swallowed, nodded, wiped his face on his sleeve, and made off through the grass as fast as he could go. Jamie put a hand to his own face, belatedly aware of a slight sting across his cheekbone. Sure enough, his fingers came away bloody.
"Not a grasshopper, then."
He wiped his fingers on the skirt of his coat, and noticed mechanically that the seam of the sleeve had burst at the shoulder, showing the white shirt beneath. He rose a little, cautious, looking round for Bixby, but there was no sign of him.
Maybe dead in the long grass, too. Maybe not. With luck, he'd see what was happening and run back to warn the companies coming up. The horse was still where he'd left it, thank God, tethered to a fence 50 yards away.
He hesitated for a moment, but there wasn't time to lose in looking for Bixby. Woodsworth and his two companies would be coming round the orchard in a few minutes and right into range of the German rifles. He popped up and ran. Something tugged at his coat, but he didn't stop and reached his horse, gasping for air.
"Chicken,"
he said, swinging up into the saddle. He turned away from the orchard and galloped through a potato field, though it bruised his farmer's heart to see what the army's passing had done to it already. I don't know when physicians began calling it the golden hour, but surely every battlefield medic from the time of the Iliad onwards knows about it. From the time of an accident or injury that isn't immediately fatal, the victim's chances of living are best if he receives treatment within an hour of sustaining the injury. After that, shock, continued loss of blood, debility due to pain, the chance of saving a patient goes sharply downhill. And in blazing temperatures, lack of water and the stress of running full out through fields and woods, wearing wool homespun and carrying heavy weapons, inhaling powder smoke, and trying either to kill someone or avoid being killed just prior to being injured, and I rather thought we were looking at a golden 15 minutes or so. Given also the fact that the wounded were having to be carried, or to walk, probably more than a mile, to a place where they could find assistance, I suppose we were doing well to save as many as we were. If only temporarily, I added grimly to myself, hearing the screaming from inside the church. "What's your name, dear?" I said to the young man in front of me. He couldn't be more than 17, and was precious near to bleeding to death. A bullet had gone through the meat of his upper arm, which would normally be a fortuitous location for a wound. Unfortunately, in this instance, the ball had passed through the underside of the arm and nicked the brachial artery, which had been spurting blood in a slow but earnest manner until I'd taken a death grip on his arm. "Private Adams, ma'am," he replied, though his lips were white and he was shaking. "Billy, they call me," he added politely.
"Pleased to meet you, Billy," I said. "And you, sir?"
For he'd been brought in staggering, leaning on another boy of about his own age, and nearly as white-faced, though I thought he wasn't hurt.
"Horatio Wilkinson, ma'am," he said, dipping his head in an awkward bow, the best he could manage while holding his friend upright. "Lovely, Horatio," I said. "I've got him now. Would you pour him out a little water with a splash of brandy in it, just there?"
I nodded at the packing case I was using for a table, on which one of my brown bottles marked Poison stood, along with a canteen full of water and wooden cups. "And as soon as he's drunk it, give him that leather strip to bite down on." I'd have told Horatio to have a tot too, save that there were only two cups, and the second one was mine. I was sipping water steadily. My bodice was soaked and clung to me like the membrane inside an eggshell, and sweat ran steadily down my legs. And I didn't want to be sharing the germs of assorted soldiers who didn't brush their teeth regularly. Still, I might have to tell him to take a quick gulp direct from the brandy bottle. Someone was going to have to apply pressure to Billy Adams's arm while I stitched his brachial artery,
and Horatio Wilkinson didn't presently look equal to the task.
"Would you?" I began. But I was holding a scalpel and a suture needle with a dangling ligature in my free hand, and the sight of these overcame young Mr. Wilkinson. His eyes rolled up in his head, and he dropped, boneless, into the gravel.
"Wounded?" said a familiar voice behind me, and I turned my head to see Denzel Hunter looking down at Mr. Wilkinson. He was nearly as pale as Horatio, and with strands of hair come loose and clinging to his cheeks, very much the antithesis of his usual collected self.
"Fainted," I said. "Can you..."
"They are idiots," he said, so pale, with rage, I now realized, that he could barely speak. "Regimental surgeons, they call themselves. A good quarter of them have never seen a man wounded in battle before. And those who have are barely capable of anything in the way of treatment save the crudest amputation. A company of barbers would do better."
"Can they stop bleeding?" I asked, taking his hand and wrapping it round my patient's upper arm. He automatically pressed his thumb to the brachial artery near the armpit, and the spurting that had started when I took my own hand away stopped again. "Thank you," I said.
"Not at all." "Yes, most of them can do that," he admitted, calming down just a little. "But they're so jealous of privilege, and so much affiliated with their own regiments, that some are letting a wounded man die because he's not one of theirs, and his own regimental surgeon is otherwise occupied."
"Scandalous," I murmured, and, "Bite hard now, Private," as I thrust the leather between his teeth and made a quick incision to enlarge the wound enough to find the end of the severed artery. He did bite, and made no more than a low grunting noise as the scalpel sliced into his flesh. Perhaps he was sufficiently in shock that he didn't feel it much. I hope not. "We haven't a lot of choice," I observed, glancing toward the big shade trees that edged the graveyard. Dotty was minding the victims of heatstroke, giving them water, and, as time and buckets permitted, dousing them with it. Rachel was in charge of depressed head fractures, abdominal wounds, and other serious wounds that couldn't be treated by amputation or binding and splinting. In most cases, this amounted to nothing more than comforting them as they died. But she was a good, steady girl who had seen a great many men die during the winter at Valley Forge. She didn't shrink from the job.
"We have to let them..."
I jerked my chin towards the church, my hands being occupied in holding Private Adams's arm and ligating the severed vessel. "Do what they're able to do. Not that we could bloody stop them."
"No."
Denny breathed out, let go of the arm as he saw I had the vessel tied off, and wiped his face on his coat.
"No, we can't. I just needed to express my anger where it wouldn't cause more trouble. And to ask if I may have some of thy gentian ointment. I saw thee had two good-sized tubs made up."
I gave him a small, wry laugh. "Be my guest.
That ass, Lecky, sent an orderly out a little while ago to try to appropriate my stock of lint and bandages. Do you need some, by the way?"
"If thee has them to spare."
He cast a bleak eye over the dwindling pile of supplies.
"Dr. McGillis has sent an orderly to scavenge the neighbourhood for items of use, and another to carry word back to camp and bring more."
"Take half," I said with a nod, and finished wrapping Billy Adams's arm with as miserly a bandage as would still do the job. Horatio Wilkinson had recovered himself a little and was sitting up, though still rather pale. Denny hoisted him to his feet and dispatched him with Billy to sit in the shade for a bit. I was digging through one of my packs for the gentian ointment when I noticed the approach of another party, and straightened up to see what their state of need might be. None of them appeared to be wounded, though all were staggering. They weren't in uniform, and bore no weapons save clubs. No telling whether they were militia or...
"We hear you've some brandy, missus," one of them said, reaching out in a quasi-friendly manner and seizing me by the wrist. "Come and share it with us, eh?"
"Let go of her," Denzel said, in a tone of deep menace that made the man holding my wrist actually let go in surprise.
He blinked at Denzel, whom he evidently hadn't noticed before.
"Who the hell are you?"
he asked, though more in tones of befuddled astonishment than confrontation.
"I'm a surgeon with the Continental Army," Denzel said firmly, and moved to stand beside me, thrusting a shoulder between me and the men, all of whom were clearly very drunk. One of them laughed at this, a high hee-hee-hee sound, and his fellow giggled and poked him, repeating, "Surgeon with the Continental Army."
"Gentlemen, you must go," Denzel said, edging farther in front of me. "We have wounded men who need attention."
He stood with his fists loosely curled, in the attitude of a man ready to do battle, though I was fairly sure he wouldn't. I hoped intimidation would do the trick, but glanced at my bottle. It was 3/4 empty. Perhaps it would be better to give it to them and hope they went away. I could see a small party of wounded Continentals coming down the road, 2 on stretchers, and a few more stumbling, stripped to their bloodied shirts, coats in their hands being dragged in the dust. I reached for the bottle, intending to thrust it at the intruders, but a movement at the corner of my eye made me look toward the shade where the girls were tending prisoners. Both Rachel and Dottie were standing upright, watching the proceedings, and at this point, Dottie, with a strong look of determination on her face, began to walk toward us. Denny saw her too. I could see the sudden shift in his posture, a touch of indecision. Dorothea Gray might be a professed Quaker, but her family blood clearly had its own ideas. And I could, rather to my surprise, tell exactly what Denzel was thinking. One of the men had already noticed Dottie and had turned, swaying in her direction. If she confronted them, and one or more of them attacked her... "Gentlemen," I interrupted the hum of interest among our visitors, and 3 pairs of bloodshot eyes turned slowly toward me. I withdrew one of the pistols Jamie had given me, pointed it into the air, and pulled the trigger. It went off with a violent jerk and a blam that momentarily deafened me, along with a puff of acrid smoke that made me cough. I wiped streaming eyes on my sleeve in time to see the visitors departing hastily, with anxious looks back over their shoulders. I located a spare handkerchief tucked into my stays and wiped a smear of soot from my face. Emerging from the damp linen folds to find the doors of the church occupied by several surgeons and orderlies all goggling at me. Feeling rather like Annie Oakley and repressing the urge to try to twirl my pistol, mostly for fear I would drop it, it was nearly a foot long, I reholstered my weapon and took a deep breath. I felt a trifle light-headed. Denzel was regarding me with concern. He swallowed visibly and opened his mouth to speak. "Not now," I said, my own voice sounding muffled, and nodded toward the men coming towards us. "There isn't time." Chapter 76. The Dangers of Surrender. 4 bloody hours. Hours spent slogging through an undulant countryside filled with mobs of Continental soldiers, clots of militia, and more bloody rocks than any place required for proper functioning, if you asked Gray. Unable to stand the blisters and shreds of raw skin any longer, he'd taken off his shoes and stockings and thrust them into the pockets of his disreputable coat, choosing to hobble barefoot for as long as he could bear it. Should he meet anyone whose feet looked his size, he thought grimly, he'd pick up one of the omnipresent rocks and avail himself. He knew he was close to the British lines. He could feel the tremble in the air, the movement of large bodies of men, their rising excitement, and somewhere, no great distance away, the point where excitement was turning to action. He'd felt the presence of fighting since just past daylight, sometimes heard shouting and the hollow boom of muskets. What would I do if I were Clinton? He'd wondered. Clinton couldn't outstrip the pursuing rebels, that was clear, but he would have had time enough to choose decent ground on which to stand and to make some preparation. Chances were
Some part of the army. Cornwallis's brigade, maybe. Clinton wouldn't leave von Knyphausen's Hessians to stand alone. Would have taken up some defensible position, hoping to hold off the rebels long enough for the baggage train to get away. Then the main body would wheel and take up its own position, perhaps occupying a village. He'd walk through two or three such, each with its own church. Churches were good. He'd sent many a scout up the steeple in his day. Where's William most likely to be? Unarmed and unable to fight, chances were that he was with Clinton. That's where he should be. But he knew his son. Unfortunately, he muttered, he would, without hesitation, lay down both life and honour for William. That didn't mean he was pleased at the prospect of having to do so. Granted, the current circumstance was not William's fault. He had to admit, reluctantly, that it was at least in part his own. He'd allowed William to undertake intelligence work for Ezekiel Richardson. He should have looked much more closely into Richardson. The thought of having been gulled by the man was almost as upsetting as what Percy had told him. He could only hope to run across Richardson in circumstances that would allow him to kill the man unobtrusively. But if it had to be at high noon in full view of General Clinton and his staff, so bloody be it. He was inflamed in every particular of his being, knew it and didn't care. There were men coming, rumbling up the road behind him. Americans, disorderly, with wagons or caissons. He stepped off the road and stood still in the shade of a tree, waiting for them to pass. It was a group of Continentals pulling cannon. Fairly small, 10 guns and only 4-pounders, pulled by men, not mules. It was the only artillery he'd seen in the course of the morning, though. Was it all Washington possessed? They didn't notice him. He waited a few minutes until they were out of sight, and followed in their wake. He heard more cannon, some way to his left, and paused to listen. British, by God! He'd had somewhat to do with artillery early in his military career, and the rhythm of a working gun crew was embedded in his bones. Sponge piece, load piece, ram, fire. A single artillery unit. 10-pounders, 6 of them. They had something in range, but weren't being attacked. The firing was sporadic, not that of hot combat. Though, to be fair, any physical effort whatever had to be described as hot today. He lunged into a patch of trees, exhaling in relief at the shade. He was ready to expire in his black coat, and took it off for a moment's respite. Dare he abandon the bloody thing altogether? He'd seen a band of militia earlier, shirt-sleeved, some with kerchiefs tied over their heads against the sun. Coated, though, he might bluff his way as a militia surgeon. The beastly garments smelled badly enough. He worked his tongue, bringing a little saliva to his dry mouth. Why the devil had he not thought to bring a canteen when he'd fled? Thirst decided him to make his move now. Dressed as he was, he might well be shot by any infantryman or dragoon who saw him, before he could speak a word. But while cannon were very effective indeed against a massed enemy, they were almost useless against a single man, as the aim couldn't be adjusted quickly enough to bear, unless the man was fool enough to advance in a straight line. And Gray was not that foolish. Granted, the officer in charge of each gun's crew would be armed with sword and pistol, but a single man approaching an artillery unit on foot could be no conceivable danger. Sheer amazement would likely let him get within earshot. And pistols were so inaccurate at anything over 10 paces. He wasn't risking much anyway, he reasoned. He hastened his step as much as he could, a wary eye out. There were a lot of Continental troops in his vicinity now, marching furiously. The regulars would take him for walking wounded, but he daren't try to surrender to the British lines while combat was joined, or he'd be the walking dead in short order. The artillery in the orchard might be his best chance, hair-raising as it was, to walk into the mouths of guns. With a muffled oath, He put his shoes back on and began to run. He ran head-on into a militia company, but they were headed somewhere at the trot and gave him no more than a cursory glance. He swerved aside into a hedgerow where he floundered for a moment before breaking through. He was in a narrow field, much trampled, and on the other side of it was an apple orchard, only the crowns of the trees showing above a heavy cloud of white powder smoke. He caught a glimpse of movement beyond the orchard and risked a few steps to the side to look, then ducked back hastily out of sight. American militia, men in hunting shirts or homespun, a few shirtless and glistening with sweat. They were massing there, likely planning a rush into the orchard from behind in hopes of capturing or disabling the guns. They were making a good deal of noise, and the guns had stopped firing. Plainly, the artillerymen knew the Americans were there and would be making preparations to resist. Not the best time to come calling, then. But then he heard the drums. Well in the distance, to the east of the orchard, but the sound carried clearly. British infantry on the march. A better prospect than the artillery in the orchard. Moving, infantry wouldn't be disposed or prepared to shoot a single unarmed man, no matter how he was dressed. And if he could get close enough to attract the attention of an officer. But he'd still have to cross the open ground below the orchard in order to reach the infantry before they marched off out of reach. Biting his lip with exasperation, he shoved through the hedgerow and ran through the clouds of drifting smoke. A shot cracked the air, much too near for him. He flung himself into the grass by instinct, but then leapt up and ran again, gasping for breath. Christ! There were riflemen in the orchard defending the cannon. Jaegers. But most of the riflemen must be facing the other way, ready to meet the gathering militia, for no more shots came on this side of the orchard. He slowed down, pressing a hand to the stitch in his side. He was past the orchard now. He could still hear the drums, though they were drawing away. Keep going, keep going. Oi! You there! He should have kept going, but short of breath and unsure who was calling, paused for an instant, half-turning. Only half, because a solid body hurtled through the air and knocked him down. He hit the ground on one elbow and was already grappling the man's head with his other hand, wet, greasy hair sliding through his fingers. He jabbed at the man's face, squirmed eel-like, out from under his weight, kneeing the fellow in the stomach as he moved, and made it lurching to his feet. "Stop right there!" The voice cracked absurdly, shooting up into a falsetto, and startled him so that he did stop, gasping for breath. "You no account filthy." The man, no, by God, it was a boy, who'd knocked him down, was getting to his feet. He had a large stone in his hand. His brother, it had to be his brother, they looked like two peas in a pod, both half-grown and gawky as turkey poults, had a good-sized club. Grey's hand had gone to his waist as he'd risen, ready to draw the dagger Percy had given him. He'd seen these boys before, he thought, the sons of the commander of one of the New Jersey militia companies. And, rather clearly, they'd seen him before, too. "Traitor!" one of them yelled at him. "Bloody fucking spy!" They were between him and the distant infantry company. The orchard was at his back, and the three of them were well within range of any Hessian rifleman who happened to look in their direction. "Look," he began, but could see that it was pointless. Something had happened. They were crazed with something, terror, anger, grief, that made their features shift like water and their limbs tremble with the need to do something immediate and violent. They were boys, but both taller than he was, and quite capable of doing him the damage they clearly intended. "General Fraser," he said loudly, hoping to jar them into